And I'm Earlin Jorston from Northfield, Minnesota, and I am doing a session today on what I call Reagan, religion, and politics. And I would have sort of three preliminary statements on this because I think it's necessary when you take on a topic like this. And first of all, there's no hidden agenda. We're with this. We're not going to pass the, you know, the collection plate afterwards or anything like that. If you might wonder, at either a political or a religious rally, sometimes people worry about that. There's no Kentucky Fried Chicken empty buckets that are, you're already digging for some. That's nice. I was kind of hopeful. But anyway, no hidden agenda. Secondly, I really encourage your participation. And we were given rather specific instructions, and I think quite rightly so, by Barb Blessing, the associate pastor here, to leave as much time as possible for discussion. And I welcome that, and I realize, and that's sort of the third point that I want to make, that this is indeed a very, a very controversial, general kind of subject. Some of you know, and this is one reason I always enjoy talking with the Elder Hostel, because I know when I mention certain names, people will understand. I mentioned Gabriel Heater, and people understand, you know, there's good news tonight. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned Will Rogers, and a lot of people remember the great old humorist from Oklahoma, among other things. And Will Rogers once, and I tell it to my 18-year-olds, and, you know, is that a new rock group or something? When they hear the name Will Rogers or whatever it is. But anyway, Will Rogers once said the surest way to get in an argument with your fellow American is to insist that you know what the best recipe for mixing religion and politics should be. That's the surest way for getting in an argument. If you've been at a dinner party, and if the hostess is, you know, on top of things, you'll know that religion and politics has already been sort of shoved to the aside as a possible topic for dinner conversation. And for whatever reasons, what is it, fools rush in where angels fear to tread, I have devoted my particular research career to a study of the interrelationships in the United States between religion and politics. And find this, like being, some of my Minnesota friends will appreciate this, I find this like being a member of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. It's usually frustrating, but it's never dull. It's usually frustrating, but it's never dull. Back in our old state, the farmer labor is just sort of an historical anachronism that they haven't dared take off yet. But then the Republicans added independent to their name, so I don't want to get involved in Minnesota politics quite yet. But anyway, I'm sure we'll get back to that. But I encourage your comment. I have to say that I am anxious, in fact, for this, because you never know what's going to happen when you talk about religion and politics and something that is as current as this particular subject. Because once I was lecturing at Elder Hostel and going back and forth on things, and somebody as close as you are to me, gentleman of about 75, stood up and he wagged his finger at me and he said, "Don't you lecture me, sonny boy." And I hadn't been called sonny boy since I'd been on my father's lap. And I was about 50 years old at the time, and I was delighted to be called sonny boy. And then people were saying, you know, isn't that terrible, and all the rest of these things. So that's what makes it fun. I really enjoy this kind of, you know, give and take. And one more thing, which I always like to mention to an audience who knows what I'm talking about. Obviously, since you know I'm from Minnesota, I come from the land of Senator Hubert Humphrey, and I always supported Humphrey for two reasons. One, we both talked too fast, and secondly, neither of us knew when to quit. And I think my Minnesota friends would agree, wasn't that true about Hubert, that talked too fast and never knew when to quit. But Hubert Humphrey, where are you now that we need you? Back, and that's another story, so that gives away my particular preference. All right, anyway. Reagan, religion, and politics. People say sometimes they want to know, you know, what the credentials are for the author in writing, and I put a couple of books, the most recent ones on the board that I've been doing research on. The one that I want to talk about today is based on a book which will come out in 1987 from the Edwin Mellon Press called Religion and Politics, the American Way, and then The New Christian Right, 1981 to 1986. That isn't in press yet. My editor decided that I needed an index, and Emily's heard this, that I told my editor when we were making the negotiations that if you make me write an index, I'm going to miss about 3 to 5 days of hiking up in the mountains in Holden Village. And he listened to me carefully, and he said, "Break a leg." And that took care of my way of trying to get out from doing an index. But anyway, that's what this particular topic today is based on. And that was based on, I did another book, sort of the preliminary to the New Christian Right and to Reagan and politics, in a book called Evangelicals in the White House, which I'm happy to say I wrote here in my sabbatical in 1980. I had the ideal world. I wrote in the morning and skied in the afternoon. And here, and I dedicated the book, in fact, to my fellow dish teamers, you know, which I often missed because I was out working on something like this. But anyway, those would be the credentials. And the commercial for tomorrow, and the topic for tomorrow is like what I call being religious in America. And if Augsburg Publishing is on the ball, they'll have this book here by the end of the week. I've just finished a book called Being Religious in America, and this is, you know, you're not going to have to buy it to get out of the building or something like this. But this is a dust jacket for this, and that'll be what I'll be talking about tomorrow. Because I'm going to argue that being religious in America is probably different than being religious in most other countries. And I want to talk about that because my field is American religious history. So, with that in mind, and with my definitely encouragement, and Brian's already warned me he's going to do it, to be controversial, I would like to start in on this. Perhaps the best thing to say is that until President Reagan became president in 1981, we had among our American presidents a rather clearly understood tradition that when the president, the chief executive, the person who, you know, according to the Constitution and according to the Founding Fathers, is to speak for all the country. You know, congressmen are supposed to speak for their own districts, senators are supposed to speak for their states, but only the president and vice president are to speak for the whole country. Okay, that was a traditional idea going way back to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and that's been continued up till this time. All right, from time to time, since we have what we call in this country civil religion, which I'll talk about tomorrow, the president does speak out on topics which could be, in a very broad sense, considered to be religious. We have Memorial Day services, for instance, which are very religious in nature. I've got a chapter in this, if that happens to interest you and you don't buying the book, on Memorial Day and the services that go along with that. And a very important one, and I say some very kind things about President Reagan and the 1984 Memorial Day service, which was held in Arlington Cemetery. It was really a remarkable kind of service, and I think that should be known. So we have the president speaking out there in sort of general religious terms. The other sort of quasi-religious holiday which we have in America, which is also connected with our government, of course, is Thanksgiving Day. Going back to Abraham Lincoln was the first. It wasn't really the Puritans who were the first to have an official holiday on Memorial Day. I mean, on Thanksgiving Day, it was really Abraham Lincoln in his period, about 1863, as I remember. And what I'm trying to say is that, as all of us know, the president always issues some sort of proclamation for Thanksgiving Day or a proclamation for Memorial Day. I remember vividly that was the case because one year I was with a group of St. Olaf students, and we were in northern Thailand in a city called Chiang Mai, and all the American citizens gathered at the embassy there, and the ambassador read the official proclamation from the president for all of us. And that was quite an important thing. The Thai people had no idea what we were talking about. I mean, this is so totally divorced from their kind of experience. But that's a very important thing for Americans to know, that in a very real sense, we believe that our national destiny is somehow associated with and intertwined in some way or another with the will of God. And we like to think, you know, of that going way back into our history and trace that right up. I hope you can remember that from History 81, but I'm not sure. But anyway, that basically is the case. All right. Now, what's happened until President Reagan, to jump right into this, what happened until President Reagan is that all the presidents from Lincoln on up made these statements about as bland and as mild and as non-controversial as possible, talking about various general things about uplift and spiritual direction and things with which neither Jew nor, you know, or Greek nor Protestant nor Catholic could take any kind of offense, because the president is supposed to speak for all the people. That's the idea. And since all the people represent in our pluralistic system, you know, a very wide variety of religious groups. In fact, in 1980, it was fascinating in terms of the total number of religious groups who claimed tax exemption, you know, from the IRS. There were at least 280 different or separate groups that claimed tax exemption from the IRS code, which gives you some indication of how broad and how vast religious diversity is in this country. Okay. But until that time, The presidents had made these very bland general kind of statements. I like to use the example in 1984. Former President Gerald Ford came to the Twin Cities to speak for a fundraiser and on behalf of Bill Frenzel, who's the Congress representative from Congress from the 3rd District. Okay, I don't know if that's Burnsville, is that the 3rd? You're in the 1st with Tim Penny? 1st, 2nd?
I don't know.
Okay, you don't know, all right. Anyway, Gerald Ford came and spoke, and he happened to preach that Sunday at the Prince of Peace Presbyterian Church, a famous church in the Twin Cities. And the point I'm making is that his remarks made page 23 in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. This is a former president, and my own personal feeling is that's just about exactly right, so far as what the newsworthy value of that should be. But I submit also, some of you remember, all of you remember, you're all adults here, how controversial the whole issue of religion and politics became in the 1984 campaign. This became an extremely lively kind of issue, which had never really been the case before. The only time religion had ever been a case, had been an issue as such before, was the Roman Catholic issue, 1920, just for fun, how many, 1928, Al Smith? Just a couple? Good. Oh, that's nice to hear and to see. There are some people, Al Smith, the old war site, the sidewalks of New York and all that sort of thing. And that was a major issue, although I think Herbert Hoover would have won no matter what. Al Smith, he could have been running on the laundry ticket, as somebody said, and it wouldn't have made any difference because the people wanted, peace, prosperity, and chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage in 1928. The other time, obviously, that all of us will remember, religion as such became an issue, was in 1960. Again, the same Roman Catholic issue with then-Senator John F. Kennedy. And Kennedy put that issue, obviously, to rest with his famous statement before the Houston meeting of especially of evangelical and fundamentalist ministers at that time. And it was that issue was so far out of consideration, so far out of the news, that people failed to notice in 1968 the vice presidential candidate, Senator Edwin Muskie, ran with Humphrey against Nixon and Agnew. And you remember, that wasn't even an issue in 1968. So fast had the Catholic issue disappeared from the scene that people didn't even consider bringing up the issue that they had raised so vigorously, you remember, against John Kennedy in 1960. And Muskie ran, and now it is an issue. Ferraro was Catholic. That didn't come up as such. Some about the statements about abortion certainly came up, and we want to talk about that, but and the controversy that created with Cuomo and Archbishop O'Connor and all the rest of these things. All right. So you see the historical background here very briefly, and what I'm trying to say is that the issue of the religion of the president had simply given in to this, what I call the Gerald Ford Bland model, model that had lasted until 1980. And then suddenly it changed, and it changed drastically, and that is what has caused a good deal of the controversy, which I think is very much alive and with us today. And if you don't think it's alive, there are those who are very serious about repealing the 22nd Amendment. So that, and very serious about this, there's a movement afoot so they can repeal the 22nd Amendment so Ronald Reagan can run for a third term. And if that doesn't, stir your interest in what I'm going to talk about here, then there's nothing, I could say that would do more than that. It was very lively concerned with what's going on here. Okay, 1980. It got started in 1980 when, at a prayer breakfast in Dallas, that's where the nominating convention was among the Republicans in 1980, President Reagan addressed a group largely of fundamentalist and evangelical ministers and made the famous statement, I know you can't endorse me. Otherwise, if organized religious bodies and individuals start endorsing candidates, obviously they lose their tax exemption. And quite rightly so. He said, I know you can't endorse me, but I want you to know that I endorse you and everything that you stand for. And that was a clear indication at that point that indeed we have a president here who, and I say this totally legally and with full protection of the Constitution and free speech and everything else, and knew just what he was doing, decided to make a clear break with the old traditional, what I call Jerry Ford Bland interpretation or position on how extensively the president of the United States, a representative of all the people, should get involved in what we would call sectarian politics. sectarian politics, and by that I mean the idea of endorsing and standing by and using the full power of the Oval Office and the White House to favor and encourage the candidacy and the agenda, the legislative agenda of one specific you know, group within this whole spectrum of what we call, you know, the American religious community on this. And that's basically what I want to talk about. And if that doesn't get a controversy started, you know, I don't know what will, in terms of mixing, you know, Will Rogers mixing religion and politics on this. And what I want to argue, so that before you fall asleep, that you know that I'm going to talk about here, because I know 4 o'clock on a day like this, and I hiked for 2 hours, and so I might be the first one to fall asleep here. I actually had a teacher once. No, he was retired by the time you went there. Anybody from St. Olaf, old Art Paulson, he actually fell asleep when he was teaching a class? Okay. Given the kind of class he taught, maybe it was just as well that he did fall asleep. He wasn't what you'd call scintillating. But that's all right. Anyway, what I'm going to argue is that what President Reagan has done is completely legal, it's completely constitutional, but is it wise? Is it in the best tradition, really, of this thing we call religious pluralism in the United States? And that's what I want to try to present to us and see, you know, how far we get with that. Because it is new and it is different, and historians are always looking for change. Historians are always looking for that which is a break from the past. We don't study the 7th century because, as far as we know, nothing happened in the 7th century. But we do study, you know, what we can prove and where we do find change. And the best definition of history, generally speaking, is change over time. And certainly what's happened in the presidency of Ronald Reagan is some remarkable change, and perhaps the most positive thing to say, and I say this straight out, is that he has, more than any other president since Ike, I think that's fair to say, he has restored confidence in the office of the presidency, more than anyone else. You may disagree with many of his policies and all the rest, but compared to his predecessors right down the line, people have enormous confidence in the person and in the office again. And you remember, just to digress for a minute here, President Nixon was always complaining about how terrible it was to be president. He wrote a book called The 6 Crises that he had faced. People don't want to hear about crises at the president. They want to hear about solutions. They want to hear about something upbeat and strong and, you know, and confident and cheerful that the president is doing. Or remember Jimmy Carter's Sunday night sermon after he'd been up in Camp David for 2 weeks, and he conferred even with, you know, no less a person than Bishop David Price. He even flew out to among other religious leaders, flew out to Camp David and consulted with him. And he came down and saying, America is in real difficulty, America's in real trouble. And then he put on his sweater instead of his coat for his fireside chat, you remember, and to save energy, sort of things. People didn't want to hear this. People wanted, you know, America to be back and all the rest. And what President Reagan has done is to restore enormous confidence in the office of the presidency. It's one of these anomalies or almost contradictions, because what has happened is that the polls clearly show that most people disagree with many, if not all, of his major policies, economic, foreign policy, and what I'll call the social agenda, but they also have enormous respect for the person. So we have one of these strange kinds of situations which can happen in America. It couldn't happen, let's say, in England, because in England you elect the people to the party, and the party elects the prime minister. The people don't have the chance to do this. So that's why we have this system where you can have a president of one party and Congress, at least the House now, of the other party. And there's this strange kind of contradiction that exists. Okay. So what happened is President Reagan made this very clear commitment to representing what I would call the evangelical fundamentalist strain or group with, you know, along the Protestant, or let's call it the Christian spectrum. And therefore, obviously, took a tremendous political risk in doing so. Because what is significant here is that with this thing I call the new Christian right, basically what I'm talking about is groups like Christian Voice and Moral Majority and Liberty Federation and the Religious Roundtable and Pat Robertson's Freedom Council. And I'll be glad to talk about Pat for President if anybody wants to talk about that, because that comes directly out of what I'm going to talk about here. What he did was to endorse what I call the social agenda, or the specific recommendations for legislation which this larger group, which I call the new Christian right, wanted to have passed. The president came out for a lot of different issues on foreign policy, taxes, you know, all these, the basic what I call stuff of politics, tariffs, taxes, you know, distribution of power through grants and loans and all this sort of thing. But he also came out for the social agenda. And the social agenda, according to the new Christian right, endorsed really four specific, what we would call, social agenda items. First of all, there was, of course, the end to legalized abortion. That was the most important, and it still is the most important item on the social agenda today. And I think it's fair to say, and I remember I was here in 1981 when Larry Rasmussen gave some fine talks, I remember, on abortion. If you're interested, I would certainly recommend you listen to Larry's